focused on Deleuze and Guattari. It's, I would say, 60% Deleuze, 30% Deleuze and Guattari, and about 10% Guattari only. But at the same time, the class is meant to also give a, let's say, very particular introduction to the field of aesthetics within philosophy. let's say, a survey of aesthetics through Deleuze and Guattari. So it means that we will be spending the first 3 weeks looking at Kant. We will move to Nietzsche, Spinoza, Bergson, and then we will be spending time on phenomenology, Merleau-Ponty, a discussion of Deleuze and Guattari's interest in German art history, and finally we will be looking at or comparing Deleuze, Guattari with a couple of other contemporary French philosophers, Alain Badiou and Jacques Rancière. That will be at the end. So, the course is an introduction to Deleuze and Guattari, to Deleuze and Guattari on art, but also a kind of a very fast run through other philosophical theories about art and aesthetics. That is the reason why you need to do a lot of reading with the class, because there's a lot of material to cover. I don't make any apologies. The lectures are fast and dense. There is a lot of material in them. If you do not do the reading before you come to class, it's going to be difficult for you to get a lot out of the lectures. So I would suggest very strongly that it's not enough to just come to the lectures if you want to write a good essay. You need to do the reading, and there is quite a lot of reading to do. Now, it's no problem for you to read the material in German. In some cases, it was written in German, so that's actually preferable. But you will need to work out what the German parts are in the German translations, for example, of Deleuze, because the list that I've given you is only just the list of the German translations, which is what is in the reader. But as I said, if it's easier for you to read it in German, please read it in German. That's no problem at all. All right. So I'm just going to start. There's going to be a sort of a small introduction today in a more general sense about Deleuze, Guattari and art, but I'm just going to start immediately, more or less, talking about Kant today, because it's a very important element, not just of aesthetics, because of course we know that more or less Kant is the beginning of kind of modern aesthetics in a philosophical sense, but also because Deleuze's reading of Kant is, I think, the central philosophical reference in terms of his own thought about art and about aesthetics. So Deleuze is a very rigorous philosopher. Anybody who's read him knows that. And his own concepts about art very much play off Kant. I say play off because Deleuze does not really follow Kant in a typical sense, but he begins from Kant and he finds some things in Kant which are useful to him, which are perhaps not actually the things that Kant really meant. I'll talk more about that. But anyway, what Deleuze gets from Kant is more or less the fundamental, let's say, starting point for his whole development of his aesthetic theory and his thoughts about art. Alright, so, what is art for Deleuze and Guattari? I'm going to start by talking about art. As it goes on, we're going to have to think more about what is the relationship between art and the philosophical discipline of aesthetics. But right now, when I say art, aesthetics, okay, we're not going to draw too much of a line. So what is art for Deleuze and aesthetics? What is art for Deleuze and Guattari? They give a very simple answer in the last book that they wrote together, which is called What is Philosophy? They say that art is sensation. This is part of a very clear distinction that they make in this book between philosophy, science, and art. Philosophy, they say, produces concepts. Science produces functions. And art produces sensation. Now, this distinction is a very important one, especially the distinction between philosophy, which produces concepts, and art, which produces sensation. I'm not really going to talk in this course about their ideas on science, maybe a little bit in relationship to Guattari, but anyway, that's the subject of another course. Maybe one day I'll do it. So, we've got philosophy produces a concept, we've got art produces a sensation. This is important in many ways. The first way that we have to recognize, and it's something that Deleuze himself acknowledges very clearly, is that when Deleuze is writing about art, he's producing concepts. He's a philosopher. He's not making art. He's making concepts about art. So this is a useful beginning point for us to orient ourselves in terms of what's going on here when Deleuze is writing about art. Deleuze is a philosopher. He's not an art critic. He's not an art historian. He's not an artist. Yeah. He is a philosopher. He produces concepts. He produces concepts about art, the first one of which is sensation. Okay. So there's a very clear distinction here between philosophy and art. This is a distinction which is not always obvious when philosophers write about art, or even when anybody writes about art. And very often there is this kind of merge, often through the use of poetic language, between the production of art and the production of philosophy. Deleuze is part of a generation of French thinkers, many of whom, inspired by Merleau-Ponty and phenomenology, amongst others, we'll look at this in more detail, a generation that produced philosophical texts that were very literary. If anybody has read any Derrida, for example, you will understand what I mean, where there is a deliberate kind of vagueness about where the philosophy stops and the art begins. Yeah? Because in the end, I mean, we're all creative, right? And on this level, perhaps the distinction is not so important. But the distinction for Deleuze is very important. Okay, that's the first thing we have to always keep in mind when we're reading Deleuze. The second thing that is very interesting about this distinction is that it has very important effects if we come to start to think about contemporary art in relationship to the writing of Deleuze and Guattari. This is something that I'll try and talk more about later on in the course. But I just want to signal it here because in the English-speaking world at least, and I have the feeling perhaps in parts of the German-speaking world as well, there is a great popularity amongst people who write about contemporary art that Deleuze is very popular. Deleuze and Guattari are one of the first kind of philosophical references for much theoretical writing about contemporary art. Now, how could we, in a very brief way, typify contemporary art? What would be one of the basic kind of definitions of contemporary art? Well, I think we have to say, after the late 60s, after the art movement that is known as conceptual art and the kind of use that conceptual art put Duchamp and Duchamp's ready-made to, we have to say that one of the fundamental aspects of contemporary art is its conceptual content. Yeah? You have to have a concept. Even if you paint portraits, even if you paint landscapes, yeah, there is still, whether the artist likes it or not, a conceptual element. Even if that conceptual element is simply, it's a representation. This is like dogma. You can't produce an image that is not a representation. So this is a concept which is fundamental to contemporary art, which is, we could almost say, a condition to contemporary art, and yet it seems that for Deleuze and Guattari, it's impossible that art can produce a concept. In actual fact, at the end, or towards the end of What is Philosophy, Deleuze and Guattari specifically reject conceptual art. Okay. As I said, I'll talk more about this later on in the course, but it's just a way of trying to orient ourselves a little bit in the more general field. How are we to use Deleuze and Guattari to think about art? To think about art. To think a concept about art. It's almost as if Deleuze and Guattari's distinction between a concept and a sensation is already, let's say, old-fashioned in relationship to contemporary practice. But at the same time, and this is a kind of an irony, it's not unique to Deleuze and Guattari, it often comes up when people who write about art want to use philosophy, but the irony, of course, is that everyone who writes about it contemporary art wants somehow to use Deleuze and Guattari. Alright, this is maybe just a question that we can come back to try to answer later on in the course. Okay, art produces sensations. What then is a sensation? Again, they're very clear. A sensation is made up of what they call an affect and a percept. Alright? What's an affect and what's a percept? An affect, it's a term that comes directly from Spinoza, and that I'll be talking about, of course, when we come to Spinoza. An affect, in the most general sense, is a feeling. Perhaps we could call it an emotion, but okay, it's a slightly problematic term for Deleuze and Guattari, but anyway, it's something, let's say, that happens inside us. In a technical sense, for Spinoza, an affect is either the increase or decrease in my body's power to act. Deleuze and Guattari call it something rather strange. They say an affect is a non-human becoming. A non-human becoming of man, or of the human, I should say. Okay. It's going to take us a bit longer to try and work out what that might mean, the non-human becoming of man. A percept, what is a percept? A percept, they say, is a non-human landscape of nature. Non-human landscape of nature. Okay, what does that mean? It means the affect, as I said, it's something that happens to us. We are affected by something, it causes a change in us. Deleuze and Guattari want to radicalize this change and say that this change is something which is no longer understandable in terms of what we might call, following Nietzsche, the human all too human. It's an inhuman becoming, a becoming inhuman. A percept is a landscape, a non-human landscape. In other words, it's something that is out there. Although in here and out there, it's going to get confused as we go along. Nevertheless, a percept is, let's say, a perception of something outside, a landscape, but whatever this perception is, it's not going to be a perception that, let's say, is conditioned by our humanity. This is already the first point where Kant becomes very important. I'll talk about more about this today, because for Kant, the aesthetic, or aesthetics, is, in one aspect anyway of it, the establishing of, let's say, the things which all humans share, which are the conditions for any possible experience. And these define a certain kind of humanity. So Deleuze and Guattari are anyway going to say, well, whatever it is that defines experience, it's not going to be human in this sense. All right, we'll see more about what that means as we go along. The next thing, in a general sense, it's very important to say right at the very beginning, is that for Deleuze and Guattari, and they say this over and over again, art has nothing to do with representation. Art cannot be understood through any kind of linguistic system. This is part of their, some people call it post-structuralism. Structuralism, for any of you who are familiar with it, basically begins from a kind of, from a linguistic framework, and uses this linguistic framework, it uses a specific linguistic framework, one that comes from Ferdinand de Saussure, to understand cultural phenomena. Now, Deleuze and Guattari are going to reject structuralism in very strong terms, and this is one of the fundamental elements of that rejection, that is that they do not want to understand art as a kind of a signifier or a representation for something else that is or is not real. So what is art then if it's not a representation, it's not a signifier? Art for them is first of all always material. This is connected to its status as a sensation. It's not a concept. So art is always something material, and it is always the expression of something. The expression of something. It's not a representation, it's an expression. Okay, we're going to have to go into a little bit more detail to understand what this distinction might mean, but it's a very important one. So art is a material expression of what? They say art makes visible invisible forces. Now we start to get into a little bit of this kind of cosmic, we could even say a little bit hippie feeling that you can get from Deleuze and Guattari. It's no surprise they are of a generation that was formed in May 68 in Paris in the so-called revolution. At that time, their cultural reference points are very much embedded in the 60s. They like to talk about Carlos Castaneda. They like to talk about psychedelic drug experiences. They like to talk about political ideas of revolution that often today seem to us perhaps a little bit utopian. But they don't make any apologies about being utopian. In fact, they explicitly say that they are utopian, and they also explicitly say that any theory of revolution is utopian. So we're not going to hold that against them, at least not yet. So, art expresses an invisible force when it makes contact with a body. The body that perceives the landscape and percepts, the body that feels these inhuman and often, they want to say, animal becomings in the affect. But this body is no longer a human body. It's no longer an organism. This body is something else, and it's what they call, following the French poet and playwright Antonin Artaud, a body without organs. It's not an organism, it's a body without organs. So already we can see that they are beginning to shift, let's say, the common sense understanding that we might have about what we are as a body, what we are as a feeling and thinking thing, and what the nature of experience that we have when we encounter art, what the nature of this experience might be. I'll come back and talk about the body without organs more later in class. Okay, so we have a sensation. It's made up of affect and percept. And these experiences, the experience of a sensation, is an expression of forces as they impact upon a material, of course, material body, which is not exactly our body. Yeah? It's not exactly, let's say, the human organism. It's something else. And what happens when this body without organs has a sensation? Well, again, they're very explicit. Almost all of this material comes from what is philosophy. What is philosophy? They say art creates the finite that restores the infinite. Art creates the finite that restores the infinite. Again, this might strike us as a somewhat old-fashioned formulation. Not just because of its kind of cosmic echo, let's say, in terms of this infinity that it evokes, but also that we could perhaps be excused for thinking that this was a formula that came out of German Romanticism, that art is the finite that restores the infinite. This is another reason why Kant is going to be so important to us, because Kant is more or less, let's say, the philosophical beginning of Romanticism. We're going to have to try and understand a little bit about what that means. So what does it mean for art to create something finite that restores the infinite? Well, this is where expression becomes so important, because in art, or in a sensation, which is finite in the sense that it is located in this relationship between the artwork and the force that it makes visible, and this body, which is not exactly my body, but is a body without organs, this finite moment, this particularity, this singularity, if you like, this is this moment, which I hope you've all experienced, where you are faced with an artwork and you feel something. This moment is both a finite moment, a singularity, a particularity, but at the same time, it expresses an infinity, a cosmos, yeah, or as Guattari calls it, a chaosmos. That's a term that comes from James Joyce, and we'll talk much more about that as we go along. It's an important concept. So, the finite art experience expresses an infinity. We will have to think about what this infinity might actually be in philosophical terms, because there's lots of different kinds of infinities. But nevertheless, what is important in this sentence is that it is expression as the function, let's say, of art, which enables the artist to create a finite object which gives an experience, or which restores infinity to the world. Perhaps infinity was already in the world, and that's in fact what Deleuze and Guattari think. But art is a kind of very privileged hotline straight into infinity. You see, you can't escape the kind of hippie overtones of Deleuze and Guattari. I know that's not kind of cool, but I like this perversity of it. You know, it's nice. All right. So, what is this infinity? Let's try and develop it a little bit more. The infinite is, in very simple terms, nature. But this is a kind of philosophical nature, not a biological nature. So again, we're going to have to work a little bit to unpack what this nature might be. But again, the echo with Romanticism is certainly there, that art is somehow an expression of a natural, living infinity. Now, this living element is very important. We've already seen that art is about a relationship to the body, the living body. But this body, as I've said, it's not the human organism, it's another kind of body. Just like nature is, of course, a living infinity, but it is not, let's say, an organic understanding of nature. It is not an understanding of the natural world and of the living processes which constitute the natural world that can be, let's say, easily understood according to our more banal understandings of nature. Nature is on the one hand material. In fact, nature encompasses both organic and inorganic substances, according to Deleuze. So it's not just the animal or the plant world, it's also involving processes within inorganic substances. But all of these processes are, we could say, vital. They are all living in a certain kind of way. A non-organic life, an inorganic life, is a term that Deleuze and Guattari take from the German art historian Wilhelm Voringer, who I'll talk more about in a later class. A kind of inorganic life. It's material, but it's vital. And in philosophical terms, these are two very important references for Deleuze and Guattari. On the one hand, materialism, and on the other hand, vitalism. And if you wanted to, let's say, maybe explain in more strictly philosophical terms what the kind of new development that Deleuze and Guattari offer is, then I think you could do much worse than suggest that this combination of materialism and vitalism is where they make a strong contribution. Maybe someone might like to write an essay about that one. All right, so we have this concept of nature as a living infinity. What does it mean, a living infinity? It means, for Deleuze and Guattari, that it is always producing. It is always producing something new. Yeah? That it is always constructing new expressions of itself. Yeah? New finite entities which express a new form of its infinity. It's a kind of feedback mechanism between the finite and the infinite. It's very important for Deleuze and Guattari, and that we'll be thinking a lot more about as the course goes on. This, they're going to call it this plane of immanence, they're going to call it, because the finite and the infinite are immanent. They are, in fact, aspects of the same thing, the same living nature. Yeah? This plane of immanence is, in fact, an ontological plane. This is about what is ontology, the philosophy of being, the philosophy of what is. But because this plane of immanence is productive, because its nature, because its living nature is vital, because it has this vitality of producing itself always new, this ontological plane of being is defined by Deleuze and Guattari, following Nietzsche, as becoming. Yeah? Being is becoming. This is famous formula, comes from Nietzsche's Will to Power, from the Nachlass, from his notebooks. This is fundamental building block of Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy. Being is becoming. So now we can kind of go back, perhaps, to our opening definitions of the percept and the affect. The affect is a non-human becoming of man, of the human. The percept is a non-human landscape of nature. Both of these things are understood as becomings. The affect is a becoming. The percept is a becoming. The affect is a becoming of, let's say, a becoming inhuman of the human. And a percept is the becoming inhuman of nature. That's a kind of shorthand way of saying that nature is not organic. So, these becomings that we have that we experience, and the affect and the percept, these are nothing more, nothing less than a sensation of the infinite vitality, the infinite productivity, the infinite becoming of nature itself. So that through art, although for Deleuze and Guattari not only through art, but anyway for us, most importantly, through art, we are able to experience the way that we ourselves, who are no longer exactly ourselves, are expressions of the cosmic infinity that surrounds us. This is very typical for Deleuze and Guattari, the way they discuss art, that it always moves between these two terms that seem, let's say at first glance, to be very, very separate from each other, which is my experience. Yeah? I go to the art gallery, I see a work of art. It seems like not only a quite banal experience, but a very, very narrow one. Yeah? But the way they want to think about it is to immediately make it a part of, to make it indiscernible from. It's a word that they like to use very much, indiscernible. To make it indiscernible from the living totality of the universe. That any experience always, let's say, is in this constant expansion and contraction from this very singular and particular point as an expression of the widest possible concept of ontological concept of what is. Yeah? What is in its totality is inseparable from what happens to me. Of course, in that process, I am dissolved and I am reconstituted as something different. Because becoming is, let's say, the logic of this experience. So, sensation, the point we started, is the realm of aesthetics. Deleuze didn't invent that. That's Kant. Yeah? Sensation is the realm of aesthetics. But as we've seen, sensation in its most expanded cosmic dimension is in fact an experience of the becoming of being. In other words, sensation is also fundamentally ontological. So, in philosophical terms, it is, I think, impossible to distinguish aesthetics from ontology within Deleuze and Guattari. That aesthetics and ontology are fundamentally linked, if not indiscernible. And that's why the trajectory of this course is going to kind of move through so many of these basic ontological thinkers through Spinoza, through Bergson, through Nietzsche, through Merleau-Ponty, and so forth and so on. Because we cannot really get a grasp of Deleuze and Guattari's aesthetics without really properly understanding their ontology. They are completely interlinked. All right. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
This sensation, what Kant meant with sinnliche Wahrnehmung, is this the same?
Sinnliche Wahrnehmung, sense perception.
Is it the same as the sensation? Or could
it's not the same. I'll spend the next 3 weeks trying to explain how it's different. But it's very much connected, let's say that. Let's say Deleuze is going to begin from a kind of strange, ambiguous relationship to Kant, where he's going to take certain things, he's going to reject others, yeah? He's going to take this fundamental definition of aesthetics as being the thought of sensation, yeah, to understand sensation. He's going to reject the framework that Kant is going to use to explain that. I'm going to try and develop how that works over the next few weeks. In fact, we can understand that relationship a little bit better by thinking a little bit about the way that Kant, that Deleuze, does philosophy, which is a, well, I was going to say singular, but I'm not sure it really is a singular way of doing philosophy, but it's an interesting way to get a grip on what his relationship to Kant might be. Deleuze began his career by writing what's called in English monographs, books about other philosophers. The book about Kant, it's a very small book, it's about 80 pages long, was written, if I remember correctly, in about 1962, 1963. It was Deleuze's third book, and it was written to be part of a series of books that explained famous philosophers for school kids, actually. But they were French school kids, so it's something kind of different. So Deleuze, let's say, fulfills his contract very successfully. He writes a small introductory book. It covers each of the three critiques. It explains in a very clear but technical way how this extremely complicated system works. But it also does something that most introductions to any philosopher, let alone Kant, never do. And that is, it interprets Kant's entire system in a way which nobody had ever really thought of before. And this is what Deleuze referred to when he spoke about his own way of doing philosophy. He said that he did philosophy, for him, philosophy was a type of ventriloquism. Now, ventriloquism is basically when you have a guy and he has like a puppet and he has his hand up it and he's sort of like, hi, how are you? Okay, that's ventriloquism, right? So it looks like the puppet's speaking, but actually it's the guy. So this is the idea about how Deleuze does philosophy. He says, yeah, I read this philosopher, Kant. But somehow, when I read him, when I did my reading, he said something that nobody ever heard before. Yeah? But, Deleuze says, I never made him say anything he hadn't said himself. So this is the idea of ventriloquism. You do a close reading of a philosopher. You explain the philosopher. But in the course of explaining the philosopher, suddenly the philosopher has become somebody unrecognizable, somebody new. It's a new Kant. The same can be said for Deleuze's Nietzsche, or Deleuze's Spinoza, or Deleuze's Bergson. And actually, many, let's say, traditional philosophers find this annoying about Deleuze, that he doesn't quite stick to the rules when it comes to explaining what the philosopher said. Deleuze also used a rather more risque metaphor for describing his relationship to other philosophers. He said he liked to take philosophers from behind and give them a mutant child. So maybe this has got more to do with sensation than ventriloquism does. But in a way, despite the perhaps slightly violent overtones of the metaphor, it also expresses something else that Deleuze often said, which is that philosophy is about friendship and it's about love. So, unfortunately, philosophy in this sense is more or less homosexual, and Deleuze is no exception to that. I mean by that, it's men talking about men. But nevertheless, Deleuze is trying to introduce into this relationship, again, some kind of gender ambiguity by the fact that it's a productive, a genetic process. He's going to give the other philosopher a mutant child. Deleuze also said that if you haven't got anything good to say, then don't say it. And again, this is another thing that many traditional philosophers find annoying about Deleuze, is that, you know, he mostly, but not all, but mostly, he says nice things about philosophers. He is always enthusiastic, yeah? He's always positive, affirmative about whichever philosopher he chooses to talk about. Many people criticize Deleuze because Deleuze never wrote a book about Hegel. And they say, hey, how can you talk on and on and on about becoming and you never talk about Hegel? That's, you know, I mean, that's weak. Right, that's weak. But Deleuze says, well, you know, I hate Hegel. So I'm not going to write a book about him. I mean, that would be a horror, right? You know, I mean, for a kind of guy like him, you know, hippie guy, who doesn't want to spend his time talking about, you know, some kind of bad scene that he's got with Hegel. In fact, in one of the seminars, this probably sums it up, he says, in one of the seminars he says, Hegel's just total crap. I like that. That's like just right to the point. Okay. So he's positive. He talks about philosophers that he likes and he talks about them in a positive way. But there's maybe one exception to this, and that exception is Kant. He said that the book he writes about Kant, he says he likes it very much. He really likes his book about Kant. He said later in an interview. But he said that when he did it, he undertook it as a book about the enemy. Kant is somehow, for him, he's the enemy, but his hatred is, let's say, balanced by a certain fascination and perhaps even a kind of perverse kind of love. In what way is this love perverse? It's not just that he wants to take him from behind and all that stuff. It's something else. Because in this book that he writes about Kant, this very small book, he first of all does something which not too many commentators, or at least people who write introductions to Kant, manage to do, and that is to show the way that the three critiques are all interconnected, and the way in which, particularly, the last critique, the third critique, is a kind of response to the first two. Deleuze says that actually Kant is a very unusual and quite amazing philosopher because he says something very important right at the end of his life. So Kant is 70 and writes the third critique. This is quite unusual in the history of philosophy that a philosopher should write a kind of fundamental text so late. But he says that it's more impressive than just coming from a man who's in the last part of his life. Because in the third critique he says, Kant tries to kind of fix the first two critiques, because he realizes that there is something missing from the first two critiques that has to be dealt with. And that's why he writes the third critique, to try and deal with it. I'll talk in more detail about how it kind of works later on. But anyway, just for now, I'll say it this way. So Deleuze is very impressed by this. And in fact, at the end of his life, in What is Philosophy, Deleuze writes about being old and having nothing left to say and all of this. And you can see it's a kind of an echo of his thoughts about Kant. But anyway, what Deleuze does in this book is he doesn't just show the way that the third critique actually, let's say, fills a gap that existed in the first two critiques. He actually goes further than that, and he shows the way that the third critique actually produces the collapse of Kant's entire system. So this is what he means about writing a book about the enemy. This is what you do. You do this kind of ventriloquism that shows the way in which your enemy's system is actually completely inconsistent. It's a kind of a perverse generosity. So this is very important, because it's exactly in the way in which Deleuze sees the third critique as collapsing that is more or less going to be the starting point for Deleuze's own aesthetics. So it's going to be in the book, which is, let's say, the beginning of modern aesthetics, the third critique, the critique of judgment, that Deleuze is going to find the beginning of his own aesthetics. But that beginning is going to be actually the collapse of Kant's own system. So I'm going to try and elaborate that over the next few weeks in much more detail. All right. So anyway, that was kind of a introduction to Deleuze and Guattari, a little bit of one. And now I want to kind of talk in a more serious way about aesthetics, and try and get the show on the road, as it were. So I'm going to start, perhaps some of you are already familiar with this, so you'll just have to kind of look out the window for a while if you are. I just want to run through a very brief historical overview of the beginning of aesthetics, and then I'm going to go on and start to talk about Kant's system. How are we going for time? Okay. All right, so aesthetics, in the sense that we understand it today, begins from the work of a German philosopher, Alexander Gottlieb Baumgarten. He's writing or living in the first half of the 18th century. Baumgarten took from Leibniz the idea that sense perception and thought are the lower and higher forms of knowledge. That both, for Leibniz, both sense perception and, let's say, the logical processes of thought gave us knowledge, but sense perception was a lower form than that of logic. This is rationalism pure, if you like. The reason why sense perception was a lower form than logic was that sense perception was always somehow confused and kind of difficult to fix. Yeah? Whereas logic, thought, it is clear and distinct. It gives clear and distinct concepts. This idea of clear and distinct is a very important one. It's not just from Leibniz, but it has a whole tradition that goes through Descartes and then on into Spinoza, where we'll come across it again. Now, for Leibniz, sense perception can be made distinct by turning it into thought. So when we think about sense perception, we're able to kind of kick our knowledge up to the higher level through the logical processes of abstraction and definition. Baumgarten, however, claimed that sense perception could have a perfection of its own that did not conform to the standard given by logic. So this is Baumgarten's kind of innovation. This meant that Baumgarten accepted there were two different kinds of knowledge, that coming from sense perception and that coming from conceptual processes or logic. But they both had their own form of perfection. Perfection in sense perception being beauty, and in thought, perfection was found through logic. Now, Kant accepts this basic distinction that Baumgarten makes, as well as his argument against Leibniz, that you couldn't privilege one form of knowledge over another. And he also takes from Baumgarten this idea that knowledge of sense perception basically defines the broad philosophical, let's say, subgenre of aesthetics. Now, the sense in which aesthetics is the philosophy of sense perception, this comes to your question now, has two senses for Kant. So there's two ways in which aesthetics defines or is a philosophy of sense perception. The first one is that aesthetics is the science of sense perception. And this is the topic of the first critique, the critique of pure reason, which is an inquiry into, let's say, what are the conditions of any sense perception whatever. So it's an inquiry into the conditions of possibility of having a perception. That's the topic of the first critique. But then, on the other side, or let's say the second aspect of aesthetics, is this idea of a science of the beautiful. Maybe closer to what we think of aesthetics today. That is, the conditions of the beautiful and of good taste. So, in other words, what are the conditions by which I find something beautiful? That's something different from what are the conditions by which I have a sense perception in the first place. Now, the distinction is that the first critique deals with, let's say, the objective conditions of experience. So it means the conditions which everybody shares under which I can have a sense perception, or by which anybody can have a sense perception. The conditions in the second sense of aesthetics are the conditions, subjective conditions, that means the conditions by which I, as an individual, find this artwork, this mountain, this meal, this. Kant's examples when he talks about art are quite famous, because he talks about things like horticulture and the designs painted on the wall and things like that. So anyway, the point is, how do I find these beautiful? What is the conditions under which I find something beautiful? On the one hand, a kind of investigation into objective conditions, and the other, subjective conditions. For Baumgarten, when our perception has perfection, then we sense the perfection of the world. So So the perfection in an artwork is actually a perfection that is a perfection of the world. It's not just my good taste or the beauty of the object. The beauty of the object transmits to me, in my experience, a perfection in the world. This is not just a perfection of a thing, but it's also a moral perfection. It's also a subjective perfection. This is, again, going to be something important that Kant is going to develop. I'll talk more about it. It is this perfection that gives aesthetic pleasure. An experience of perfection gives me pleasure, and the pleasure is what defines the beautiful. Beauty is a perfection that gives me pleasure. Now, because perfection implies a standard, there are rules of beauty that are derived from rules of perfection in general. And Kant is going to explore these in the Third Critique when he talks about the purposiveness of art. It means that art's purpose is actually the same as the purposes of nature. So when art expresses perfection, it expresses a perfection of nature. This is again something he inherits from Baumgarten. The aim of art, then, is to create a perfect whole out of indistinct images, making these images clear and unified and able to be judged as beautiful. Yeah? Now, this is, again, something I'm going to talk more about, but in many ways, this is a kind of a form of classicism. Yeah? That it is the clarity and the distinction of the image which is what gives it its beauty. This is classical theory of art, classicism. Yeah? It's the outline. For example, in Aristotle says, you know, philosophically, ontologically, what comes first is the outline. That's the most important thing, because that shows the being of the object. And the colour is just like in a colouring book. The colour just comes in afterwards to fill in the kind of gaps. It's the line which is what is important. And that, of course, is true of classical art. It's what the Renaissance takes from classical art and explores even further until, you know, you start to get these strange experiments in Venetian painting where colour suddenly emerges in this very modern way for itself and so forth and so on. And from this point, you get this Calare versus Designio debate, which animates discussions of art right up to the present day, which is more important, the outline or the colour. Yeah? The colour, the affirmation of colour as being the most important element in art. I mean, we're talking about painting, of course, all through this time. In art is a much more romantic concept. Yeah? Colour is connected to feeling. Colour is not about clarity. Colour is about intensity. Yeah? But anyway, in this stage, in these terms, Baumgarten's theory is still classical in as much as it affirms beauty as being a kind of perfection which derives from the clarity of the image. I'm going to come back to this because it's a point that Deleuze makes that's quite important, which is that Kant kind of straddles this transition, this historical transition between classicism and romanticism, that the Third Critique is more or less, let's say, the philosophical impetus for romanticism. And romanticism, as I've already kind of suggested, is going to be a kind of a subterranean echo that comes back through Deleuze and Guattari's writings on art. So we need to be a little bit aware of it. Now, Kant accepted that sense perception was not the same as thought, and that sense perception can be perfected. But Kant objected to the way that Baumgarten analysed the perception of beauty as a property of perception in general. Which means, if you do this, if The perception of beauty is only, let's say, an aspect of a more general theory of perception, then it means that judging beauty relies upon a concept, and this, in the end, confuses the original distinction between sense perception and thought. So Kant is wanting to try and avoid this confusion. Kant argues that if judgments about beauty were conceptual, then it could be proved by rules. And he says, it can't. There are no rules about beauty. This is going to be one of the fundamental elements of the third critique. This idea, for those of you who have done a course on Kant, I presume plenty of you have, this idea of the free harmony of the faculties in the third critique that emerges, that there is no legislating faculty. Yeah? There are no rules. It's a harmony. It's a free play. Yeah? It's not legislated by any faculty. Okay, I'm going to talk much more about this as we go along. So as a result, Kant said, Baumgarten fails to explain the subjective character of judgments about beauty. Kant says, Baumgarten wants to make subjective judgments of beauty depend upon a universal conceptual framework. Yeah? That he wants there to be a logic to beauty which can be thought. Kant says, well, that's crazy, because beauty, it's a feeling. It's a subjective perception. You can't take rules of thought and apply them to a subjective feeling. So, in response, Kant is going to try and find an analysis of aesthetic judgments, of judgments about beauty, that is universal. He does want it to be universal. But he wants these judgments not to rest upon the cognitive faculty of the understanding or the practical faculty of reason. I'll talk more about what that means. It means he wants to find a way of understanding aesthetic judgments. He wants to understand the universality of aesthetic judgments. He wants to understand why everybody thinks Mozart is beautiful, or Bach, or whatever. Yeah. But he wants to find that universality within, let's say, subjective processes of sense perception. He wants to find those within the realm of feeling and not within the realm of cognitive understanding, nor within the realm of moral behaviour, which is the second critique. So this is kind of the way that Kant builds on, but also departs from, Baumgarten. All right, so now I want to start talking about Kant's system. We've got a little more time. Is it possible to open a window? Because thank you. Alright. So how many people have done a course on Kant? Quite a few. Good. That's good. Deleuze says a very nice thing about Kant. He says, this is a quotation. For those of you who don't know of it, there's a website which has Deleuze or some of Deleuze's seminars that he gave. Many of Deleuze's books were based upon his seminars. And you can go to the website, the address is on the reading list, and there are four seminars about Kant. The second one is on the required reading for the next few weeks, so please go and check it out. I'll just write the address on the board for those of you who don't have the... There's seminars on Spinoza and Leibniz. It's very useful because the seminars are, you know, they're transcripts of what he said. So it's much more relaxed than the book, you know, and it's easier to understand.
Could you read it loud, please? I can't read it.
The address?
Yes.
www.webdeleuze, all one word, .com /PHP /Sommaire, Sommaire, .html. Okay? All right. So I recommend you looking at the seminars because they're a more easy introduction into Deleuze's thought. They're a bit more, they're not quite so kind of hard as the written texts. Anyway, in one of those seminars on Kant, maybe this is a good example of the kind of style that he has, Deleuze says, it must be said that it is a very stifling philosophy. It's an excessive atmosphere. But if one holds up, and the important thing is not to understand, the important thing is to take on the rhythm of a given man, a given writer, a given philosopher. If one holds up, all this northern fog which lands on top of us starts to dissipate. And underneath, there is an amazing architecture. When I said to you that a great philosopher is nevertheless someone who invents concepts, in Kant's case, in this fog, there functions a sort of thinking machine, a sort of creation of concepts that is absolutely frightening. So I think it's a good quotation because you get a sense of Deleuze's ambivalence about Kant. On the one hand, he thinks, yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's this kind of explosion, this architecture, this labyrinth that you can't find your way through. But at the same time, you can tell that Deleuze, he has an admiration for the thinker, for Kant, for the genius. Huh? Genius, it's one of Deleuze's favorite words. Yeah? He always talks about genius, another kind of old-fashioned mannerism. So, the other thing that's good about this quotation is that it contains useful advice for everybody who wants to be a philosopher, and that is, the important thing is not to understand. It's our very Deleuzian concept. Because when we understand, when we think we understand, we're always a very small step away from the cliché, from dogma, and from the banal. So the important thing is not to understand. The important thing, he says, is to take on the rhythm of a given man, to undergo a kind of becoming, if you like, to try and feel the rhythm of a thinker, to try and feel the rhythm of a thought, and this is the way that you will get rid of the fog, the northern fogs that surround Kant. And I'm sure anybody who's tried to read some Kant will be well familiar with the fog that sometimes it seems impossible to see through. I include myself completely within that. always found him quite confusing. But I'm going to try and explain it to you, so now you have a lot of confidence, I'm sure, in my abilities to do that. Okay. So, Kant, then, in terms of aesthetics, he emerges as a, well, not just in terms of aesthetics, but in terms of his system in general, it's a kind of double response. On the one hand, to the rationalism of Leibniz, on the other hand, to the empiricism of Hume. He takes important elements from both Leibniz and Hume, but he also offers important counter-arguments to both of them that allow him to construct his own system. Now, as I mentioned, for Leibniz, beauty is the appearance in the indistinct realm of the senses of the perfection of an idea. This reflected Leibniz's belief that the world was in principle knowable, inasmuch as its a priori truths, these are truths which are true without any, let's say, perception of anything, so we don't have to perceive anything to know that an a priori truth is true. These ideas, as Leibniz called them, were deducible through logic. So, in order to discover the perfection of a sense perception, we needed to examine the, let's say, ideas or a priori truths which he thought structured sense perception. And you could do this through logic. So, a priori concepts is very important for Kant. Are true independent of experience, therefore they are necessary and universal. Okay, Hume, on the other hand, agreed that a priori truths were derivable from logic, but he claimed that these truths only had to do with concepts and with conceptual thinking and were not to do with the real world or the objects of sense perception. Hume argued that we can only encounter the world through sense perception, and as a result, sense perception does not guarantee any a priori truths or a priori knowledge. So for Hume, all knowledge of nature is contingent, and when we say that we know something about nature, we're not expressing knowledge, we are expressing instead or describing habit. So, for both the rationalists and the empiricists, for both Leibniz and Hume, it was God that guaranteed the connection between the subject and the object. And the accord, he also guaranteed the accord between the order of ideas and the order of things, between the world of thought and the world of perception. They both required God in order to explain how it was that we have knowledge of the world. Real knowledge, not just habit. This is the sense in which Kant launched, this is a kind of a cliche about Kant now, that Kant launched, well actually it comes from Kant, he claimed it himself, a Copernican revolution in philosophy. Okay, Copernicus is the one who discovered that the earth revolves around the sun instead of the sun revolving around the earth. So Kant launches a Copernican revolution by making the object depend upon the subject. So, in other words, instead of there being a truth that came or was within the object that the subject perceives, it was in fact the perception of the subject which determined the truth of the object. It's this fundamental reorientation of the relationship, the fundamental relationship of sense perception. It means that Kant places rational being at the center of the universe. This is obviously a fundamental moment of enlightenment. Yeah? The rational being is now the center of the universe and the determiner of truth. And as Deleuze puts it, the Copernican revolution teaches us that we are given the orders, not God. We are given the orders. Now, God still exists in Kant, but God has a different position than he does for both rationalism and empiricism. And God is no longer the kind of necessary guarantor of knowledge. We find our own guarantee within the way that we perceive and the way that we think. So Kant wants to forge a path that lies between rationalism and empiricism, arguing that there were some basic laws of nature that are not derived from reason alone, from logic, but come from experience. This leads to one of Kant's fundamental questions, which is, how are synthetic judgments possible? Now, a synthetic judgment is a judgment that gives a property to an object. Yeah? And, in other words, it puts two things together. And it's something that we do continually in experience. So when you say the rose is red, it's a synthetic judgment. So the question is, how can we discover a priori synthetic judgments?
How do you spell that?
Synthetic judgments. Okay, now, there was a certain urgency for Kant to answer this question about how synthetic judgments were possible, how a priori synthetic judgments were possible. Because it seemed as if, after Newton, this was precisely what science, a priori synthetic judgments that are being produced. Of course, science is not in the business of trying to conceptualize the foundation of these judgments, it just provides repeatable results. It's the basic fundamental scientific definition of truth. But nevertheless, it seemed as if these were entirely possible to actually formulate. So Kant wants to try and understand, okay, how is it possible to do this? The way that he does it is by elaborating a higher faculty of knowledge which does not depend upon a representation or an experience, but nor is it purely logical or ideal. Yeah, so it's neither a sense perception, but neither is it entirely an abstract conceptual entity. These, he wants to say, are the synthetic a priori judgments that govern any possible experience but do not depend on them. So these are not synthetic judgments of the type the rose is red, obviously. These are something a little bit more fundamental. So this is the sense in which Deleuze says that in Kant's system, we give the orders. Yeah? That it means that the relation between the subject and the object is determined by a priori synthetic judgments that apply to every experience and make any experience possible. But these a priori synthetic judgments are found within the subject and not within the object. They are the subjective conditions of possibility for any given experience. Now, in order to discover what these a priori synthetic judgments might be, Kant is going to examine the process of perception and thought itself. So he's going to examine what sense perception is. He's going to examine what happens when we have a sense experience, when we identify an object and give it properties in the world. He's going to examine these things in a great deal of detail in order to discover what this framework of possibility, what these conditions might be. Now, this process is basically the process by which thought examines itself. Thought examines its own process, its own process of perception, its own process of understanding. There is no position outside of that process from which there can be a point of view on thought. As soon as you are examining thought, you're already thinking. So, as a result, this process, or this approach, is called an immanent critique. It is the critique that thought makes of itself. Now, this is one element of Kant that Deleuze likes very much, because for Deleuze, of course, Deleuze is a philosopher of immanence. For Deleuze, there is no outside to thought, to sensation, to life. And although the outside is a concept in Deleuze, this concept of the outside, it only exists as a genetic element within the living system. So even in this sense, everything remains immanent. Deleuze writes, "An immanent critique, reason as the judge of reason, is the essential principle of the so-called transcendental method." And in many ways, Deleuze's philosophy itself is a kind of immanent critique and a kind of transcendental method. I'll talk more about that in the next weeks. All right, now we'll start to get a little bit more technical. For Kant, every representation is related to an object and a subject. A representation we can understand in this sense as being an experience, a perception. So a perception is a relationship between an object and a subject. But there is more than just one possible relationship between an object and a subject. And for Kant, for every relation or type of relation between an object and a subject, there is a faculty of the mind which determines that relation. First of all, there is the faculty of knowledge. This determines the agreement of a representation or perception with its object. It explains how we experience something. And this is the subject of the first critique, the critique of pure reason. Then there is the faculty of desire. This faculty determines how an experience causes us to desire something. It explains the conditions by which we will something to happen. How is it that we want something to happen? How is it that we try and make something happen? This is something different from how is it that we have a sense of perception. This also involves a fundamental question for Kant, which is, how is it that we are to imagine our own freedom? That is, our freedom to desire something or to want something. So this is the faculty of desire, and this is discussed in the critique of practical reason, the second critique. Finally, there is the faculty of pleasure and pain, and this determines how a representation increases or decreases a subject's vital force. This explains why we like or dislike something. This is the subject of the third critique, the critique of judgment. Now, each faculty finds its own higher form when it discovers in itself the law of its own exercise. This is the object of the immanent critique, is to find within each faculty the law through which this faculty operates. It's this law which makes each faculty autonomous by giving it its own conditions of operation, and it also makes it transcendental because it is universal, because it determines how everybody understands, desires, or feels. It's also an important element of Kant's approach. In each faculty, this immanent critique defines a common sense. It means a common way of understanding, desiring, morality, moral, common moral standard, and feeling, liking or disliking something. Okay, there is another sense of the term faculty in Kant, which describes a specific source of representations. And this is another way that he uses the word faculty. In this sense, there is as many faculties as there are types of representation. There is the faculty of the imagination. This faculty relates a raw sense experience to an object of experience. And this has its source in what Kant calls intuition. This means that we have our senses, we have our eyes, and our ears, touch, so forth and so on. And these give us certain kinds of information about the world. But this information is kind of, it's raw and it can't be comprehended in itself. There has to be certain kind of, let's say, laws of processing by which this raw sense information can be attached to an object. So I experience colours, sounds, smells, whatever, but there has to be certain ways that this sense experience is processed in order for it to become an object. That's what Kant is going to try and show. That's the faculty of the imagination, which basically does that, which basically takes the raw sense experience and which kind of organizes it into an object. Then there is the faculty of understanding. This relates this representation of an object, this relates the representation to an object through a concept. The concepts provide the conditions of possibilities of a representation. It seems a bit confusing now. I'm going to talk in more detail about it in the next couple of weeks, but basically there are these kinds of fundamental concepts such as cause and effect, quality, quantity, these kinds of general abstract concepts through which any representation has to pass in order for it to become an object of experience. So these are these kinds of transcendental categories, actually, Kant is going to call them, which are abstract concepts, but which are a kind of machinery through which sense experience passes in order to become an object. This is the faculty of the understanding. And finally, there is the faculty of reason, which relates experience and action to a concept that goes beyond the possibility of experience, and which Kant calls an idea. This is kind of the rationalist part of Kant, if you like. An idea is supersensible and transcends experience. You can't actually experience these ideas, but in a certain way that we will go on to see, these ideas are going to determine various elements of experience and especially of moral action. And these ideas of reason are things like God, the soul, nature in its totality, these kinds of things. You can't experience them actually themselves, but they have to exist within the system in order for there to be a certain coherence. Not just in order for there to be a certain coherence, because you can't have a system without God at this time. That's actually what Spinoza found out, because Spinoza was, he was a heretic. Not because he denied God, but just because he said that God was the same as nature. So that was enough for him to be an atheist. But we'll get to that. All right, well, I think we'll stop there, that's about it. And we'll carry on next week with the critique.